Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, the weekly show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. And today, a special Christmas Eve edition of the programme. Always enjoy presenting the show on Christmas Eve, as it's also my birthday as well. But wherever you are, however you're celebrating Christmas this year, I do wish you a very happy Christmas. Today, our subject on the programme is the Star of Bethlehem, asking fact or fiction with my Christian and non-Christian guests. I'll be introducing them in a moment's time. Loads more Christmas programming coming up straight after Unbelievable. At 4 o'clock, we've got A Christmas in Swaledale, the Reverend Caroline Hewitt in her 4x4 travelling around the Yorkshire Dale of Swaledale, tending to her flock at the run-up to Christmas. 5 o'clock, Christmas carols from St Andrew's Cathedral in Glasgow. And at 6 o'clock, Tinsels and Towels. Lisa Mannering explores the fun, hilarity, harmony and magic of the school nativity play. Well, we're going to be doing part of the nativity story on today's programme. Apologies in advance for my voice. This was recorded before I went on the Christmas break. And you'll hear that I had a little bit of a rough throat. But it's all perfectly audible. Hope you enjoy today's programme.
You're unbelievable.
Well, welcome along to today's programme. Was there a Star of Bethlehem, we're asking on the show today. In this Christmas Eve edition of Unbelievable, we're following the Star of Bethlehem, or at least following the evidence for and against it. The Star of Bethlehem, which the Gospel of Matthew says led the Magi to the infant Jesus, is an indispensable part of every nativity play. But what is the evidence that a celestial phenomenon occurred at that time that would have been visible in that part of the world? Various theories have been put forward, and we're going to hear people on different sides of the debate today. Mark Kidger will be joining me. He's an astronomer with the European Space Agency. He's an agnostic, but has written about what the Star of Bethlehem, if it existed, could have been in his book, The Star of Bethlehem, An Astronomer's View. He's currently working on a revised edition of the book. Colin Nicol is a Christian. His recent book, The Great Christ Comet, Revealing the True Star of Bethlehem, looks afresh at the evidence and makes the case that the Star of Bethlehem could only have been a great comet. And finally, Aaron Adair is an atheist. His book, The Star of Bethlehem, A Skeptical View, argues that none of these scientific explanations of the star succeed and that it was most likely a theological invention. So we've got a few different views represented on the programme today. Let's start off by saying a hello to two people joining me via Skype, Colin and Aaron. A very good afternoon to you both, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Justin.
Good afternoon and good morning from the US.
Indeed, you're joining us from the US, Aaron. Colin, you're coming, I think, from Northern Ireland, is that correct?
That's right. That's right.
It's great to have you both joining me today. Let's start with yourself, Colin. Tell me a little bit about what made you interested in pursuing the whole issue of the Star of Bethlehem.
Well, that's a good question. It's not a topic that I was interested in myself prior to 2009, really. My father-in-law was interested in the Rick Larson DVD documentary on the Star of Bethlehem, and that in a sense ignited some interest in it. I wasn't enamored with that DVD. I saw a lot of problems with it, but it got me interested in going back to the text of Matthew with the thought there must be a solution to this. And so that got me really investigating the issue in a kind of vague way for a couple of years, but I was getting a little bit more into some astronomy at that time. Then a couple of years after that, I was dialoguing with some astronomers about some other topics and started to put together some ideas of what the star, it seemed to me, had to be. And that started me really on this project, which led me into all kinds of fresh areas of research and study and into relationships with astronomers and other scholars across the world that have nothing to do with biblical studies. So it certainly has been a very interesting and stretching but very rewarding journey.
Yeah, so it really started out as just a kind of a vague interest, which developed into this full-blown book, which got really great reviews when it came out last year. And in a sense, you do survey a number of the different theories that are out there. I mean, I've had people in the past get in touch with me about Rick Larson's DVD. Do you want to just briefly explain what his view, what his theory is that he puts out on that particular DVD of what the Star of Bethlehem would have been and why you weren't, in the end, convinced by it yourself?
Essentially, he says that the Magi were enthralled by the movements of Jupiter from 3 to 2 BC, and that the Magi would have perceived those movements in the sky to be significant. In particular, Jupiter had conjunctions with Venus, and then various comings together with the star Regulus, which Rick Larson saw to be very important. And then he believes that the Magi traveled to Judea on the back of seeing this these various things happening, and Jupiter's apparent motion in the sky stopped. And then the Magi took that to be a cue that the baby Jesus was in Bethlehem. I mean, the theory seems flawed on a lot of levels. Jupiter as a planet is a regular, predictable feature of the sky. It doesn't suddenly appear as the Star of Bethlehem seems to have. At the same time, you know, the word rising doesn't seem to feature in Larson's explanation, not in a convincing way anyway. The idea that the Magi are going to base their stopping in Bethlehem simply based on Jupiter's motions is a bit hard to believe. You know, and the chronology that he sets out is a bit unbelievable. The journey takes an absurdly long time. There's even a month-long stay of the Magi in Jerusalem. It's even inconsistent regarding what the star really is, because sometimes he thinks it's Jupiter and other times he implies it's Regulus, which is the star in Leo. So all in all, when you add that together with the fact that he has to redo the date of Herod's death to 1 BC, which is contrary to what most historians would go for, they would go for a 4 BC date. The Larson theory really, you know, doesn't have much going for it.
Well, we'll come back to you for your theory in a short moment's time. Let's introduce one of our other guests now, Aaron Adair. Aaron, welcome along to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Aaron, you got in touch with me years ago now, and it was just through flicking through some old emails that I thought, oh, Aaron might be up for a discussion on this on Christmas Eve. But you're an atheist. Have you ever had any kind of leanings towards Christianity in the past, Aaron?
Oh, well, I grew up in a Roman Catholic household, though cafeteria Catholic might be more accurate. And on this subject matter, when I was first investigating it myself, I think the better term for me might have been Catholic deist.
I see. And you sort of had an openness to it in that sense, did you?
Well, just to give a little of my own story, I basically first discovered these things when I, it was my first year of college, and I was working as a show presenter at the planetarium at our university. And apparently there have been planetarium Star of Bethlehem shows all the way back to the 1930s. I see the show, I'm like, wow, this is very interesting, science and conformity with religious doctrine and completely non-miraculous. So this fit my worldview wonderfully. Later though, I go home and there's some TV special on about the same subject, and they propose a different theory. And then I realize, wait, there's not one, there's two, there's, okay, I'm running out of fingers to count them all. What's going on here?
So you eventually ended up writing a book, but obviously from a skeptical point of view about the whole thing. I mean, at some point you, I think, abandoned any kind of faith commitments at all. And give us the very brief summary of kind of your search through the various different theories that have been propounded about the Star of Bethlehem.
All right. Well, one of the things I've actually done was a larger survey of everything written on the subject matter. And I mean that rather broadly, pretty much everything written since the second century to today, I've written an article on. And basically, up until about the 19th century, all the references you're going to find are referring to the Star of Bethlehem as some miraculous object. In the 19th century, things are changing a bit because miracles are becoming a little bit more difficult to believe in, a la David Hume's arguments against miracles. There's a wave in biblical studies to explain every miracle in the Bible as some weird natural phenomenon. Jesus walking on water, the apostles just misunderstood. He was just walking on the beach at the time. Imagine that for every miracle story, including the virgin birth, including the resurrection, Star of Bethlehem explanations come out of this same milieu. And pretty much everything in the sky you've ever looked at has been proposed by someone to have been the Star of Bethlehem, including some things that probably haven't been in the sky, including extraterrestrials. That's been seriously suggested as well.
So where did all this searching lead you in the end then, Aaron?
Ultimately, the explanations that seemed best were the ones that biblical scholars had been basically in conformity or in consensus with since about the mid-19th century. Best explanation is that it's some sort of theological narrative, ultimately basing itself on things like the star prophecy from the Old Testament, Numbers 24:17.
Well, we're discussing the Star of Bethlehem on today's program, special Christmas Eve edition of Unbelievable. A little later on in the program, hoping for Mark Kidger to join in as well. Mark is an astronomer with the European Space Agency. But for now, we're talking to Colin Nicol and Aaron Adair. And we'll be coming back to Colin Nicol in a moment, whose recent book, The Great Christ Comet, looked at the evidence afresh for the Star of Bethlehem. If you want to get in touch with today's show, don't forget you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also send me your thoughts via Twitter and Facebook. Get in touch those ways at UnbelievableJB. To follow me on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB, if you'd like to get in touch via the Facebook page and see what we post up on a regular basis there. Don't forget all of those links and links to my guest today available from the website as usual. PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, coming back to you then, Colin, you know, perhaps it'd be interesting to hear your responses to some of what Aaron has to say there. And what has led you as a Christian to believe that this isn't just the theological fancy, if you like, or invention of people who were chronicling the life of Jesus and kind of wanted to, as I've often heard it put by skeptics of the Bible, you know, give him kind of divine, kind of celestial signs to portend his birth. What makes you convinced this was a real historical, astronomical event in that sense?
I mean, I think a large part of our disagreement would come down to what we make of the historical reliability of the Gospels. Generally, you know, I would see there as being a stable transmission of the stories of Jesus with many written sources that the gospel writers are using. I see the importance of eyewitness testimonies. There's a real kind of culture of memory in Judea at the time. The recent studies in the psychology of memory indicate the type of things that tend to be remembered best from eyewitnesses, a book by Richard Bauckham on this. So we have, you know, unusual events, consequential events, emotionally involved events, vivid, frequently rehearsed events all tend to be better remembered. Jesus, of course, training his disciples with a view to remembering and passing on his traditions when he's gone. So many of those things. And I think Aaron and I would disagree on the nature of Matthew as a biographer and how good he is as a biographer. It seems to me that Matthew is a very conservative redactor. If you look at his use of Mark, you see that he takes over 90% of Mark and often sticking to the exact script of Mark. so much so that a number of scholars have suggested that Mark is almost more of an editor than he is an author. So I think when you compare that and you are able to look at the sources and Matthew's handling of sources, I think you see that he is, at least I would perceive that he is a good biographer. He shows a concern for accuracy and preserving truth. So, you know, there's other things we can do, other indications of that. When it turns to the star in particular, it seems to me that, you know, when we look at Josephus and we look at his account of Herod's final years, the account that we see in Matthew is very compatible with that. It seems to me it's an unlikely choice of these magi, these foreigners, in my opinion, much more likely to be astrologers, astronomers. Very unlikely that you would invent a story that would have them as kind of the heroes. The fact that we have this reference to the babies being slaughtered up to those in their second year, suggesting that this star has been visible for a long time. That, again, is a detail difficult to explain if it's just a myth. So I think when one looks at this kind of thing, one has to make a judgment on whether one trusts Matthew's testimony and then whether one views the star account as a plausible account. Sure. And I think unless one is kind of predisposed not to believe in anything extraordinary or unusual, I think that, you know, one can look at this and say, well, no, this is an account that we can consider and evaluate its historical credentials.
Sure.
The key question being, you know, what is the genre? If Matthew is theological biography with a historical interest, then that's what we get.
I mean, one of the issues that Aaron raised there was the question of whether it was the right move, you know, on the part of people in the 19th century, particularly to start to try and explain all biblical miracles with natural occurrences, and that the Star of Bethlehem is a case in point. Now, presumably, you don't believe in explaining away all the miracles in the Bible as just, you know, oh, natural events that they mistook as miracles. But in this case, you're prepared to kind of point to a natural event as being what this star was, that it wasn't in that sense a miraculous event, something out of the ordinary that happened when the Magi saw this star.
That's correct. I would take issue a little bit with what Aaron said, in that as though it was an entirely supernatural view up until the 19th century. I think there's many instances in the early church where there, at best, one could say there's an ambiguity regarding any identification of what the entity was. I think the description of Ignatius at the beginning of the second century, but probably citing a tradition into the first century, talking about the star being bright and the star being something that caused astonishment. It certainly is a public phenomenon, and you know, it seems to me perfectly compatible with an astronomical explanation if we just allow some kind of hymnic aspects to the material. As for origin, origin seems to me, and I think the vast majority of scholars, to clearly say that the star was a comet and make an argument for that, among other things, pointing out that comets had good senses, good, that could be positive omens on occasion, and quotes a first century Stoic who gave examples of positive instances of comets, and we know ourselves of positive instances of comets also. So I do think that there is, it's not quite as clear-cut as Aaron's saying in that regard. As for biblical scholars, certainly when I look at biblical scholarship, you see an interest. Almost every commentator will rehearse the various possibilities of what the star might have been. And, you know, it's not uncommon for them to side with an explanation like the 7 BC triple conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn in Pisces, or it being a comet in 5 BC. And I know, for example, Craig Keener is one who's opted for the comet view in particular. I mean, I suppose when one's looking at this, the problem, one of the problems I have with what Aaron's saying is that the numbers 24:17, yeah, it seems to be alluded to in Matthew 2. Aaron also thinks in his writings, that Virgil's Aeneid has given rise to this, that there's parallels there with a shooting star going over rooftops and then landing in the forests of Mount Ida. And then there's a Venus rising over Mount Ida at the end of a journey. But to me, those parallels don't seem very compelling. It doesn't seem that the star, that, for example, the shooting star is really in any important sense over the house or over any house. It's simply zipping across the sky into the forests. As for the shooting star, that's a planet. So in this way, if Matthew's inspired to make this story up because of these two things, it's actually two supposedly natural things, one being the numbers 2417, which is quite commentary, and we'll talk about that in a little while, and then the Aeneid material, where these things are a meteor and a planet, Venus. So you would have Matthew being inspired by a planet and by a shooting star, two natural phenomena, inventing a supernatural body. And, right. And it's hard for me to imagine when you're inventing a supernatural star, what is that? How do you do it? Surely you're basing it off of natural phenomena.
Okay. Do you want to respond to any of this, Aaron, before we come to Colin's actual case, if you like, for the Star of Bethlehem?
Oh, if you'll please let me. So on the point on first the reliability of our gospel narrative, if we do take the position of some that the gospels are biography, ancient biography, if we accept that, that doesn't necessarily mean we accept its details. For example, Plutarch has biographies of people who never even existed. So to really get down to and say, are things reliable? The question is, what are the sources and how good are the sources that Matthew used? How did he use them? What sources did Matthew use? Let's look at what he told us. Oh, he didn't tell us what his sources were. So we're actually pretty much speculating about what his sources were, if he even had sources, because he just doesn't tell us. So ultimately, it's a question of, well, how reliable can it be when we don't know who wrote this, when they wrote it, what sources they used, how credible those sources were? And when you put speculation on speculation, you need to at least be a bit more skeptical on the final result. Now, when it comes to, of course, the nature of the star, Colin wanted to push back a bit with a couple of examples from antiquity. Origen is interesting because he's often been either misread or incompletely read on the Star of Bethlehem being a comet. He said it was a comet insofar as they are both like symbols of great things are going to happen. They're cosmic messengers. Not that that the Star of Bethlehem was itself a comet, some, as he would have believed, an atmospheric phenomenon. And in fact, in one of his other commentaries on Numbers, he actually says the star came over the house Jesus was in the same way the dove came upon Jesus at the baptism. That sounds pretty supernatural to me. At the very least, stars don't do that. And as for Ignatius, considering his star hymn includes things like all the other stars, the sun and the moon dancing around this star in the heavens and was supremely bright, and there's all the stars singing. This sounds not quite like an astronomical observation. And also most scholars looking at this say the star is not just a star in the sky, but this is actually Jesus as a star.
Right. Do you want to respond to any of that, Colin?
First of all, I suppose the fact that Matthew doesn't say what his sources are would suggest to me that it does not really have a lot of weight. I mean, granted that biblical studies, New Testament studies, has been focused for a significant time on sources criticism, redaction criticism, which is the deducing what sources Matthew is using and how he's using those sources. One, I suppose, has to make a decision which hypothesis one's going to follow. But if one follows, for example, Markan priority, which is the majority position today, then we can work out what Matthew's sources are and how he's using his sources. And we can say that he is very conservative in his use of sources and that he is therefore very likely to be reliable as a writer. I don't believe it's right to say because we don't know You know, we don't know 100% certain who wrote it or exactly when. I don't think that undermines credibility or a speculation upon speculation. We're dealing here with a pretty narrow range of dates by most scholars, from the 60s to the 80s. That it seems to me, either way, we're talking about the use of sources, many times written sources. Those that believe in a four-source hypothesis would accept not only Mark, but Q and Matthew's own written sources or oral sources. So, I mean, it's not as simple, I think, as Aaron.
Okay, I'm going to give Aaron the last word just on this section of the program, because Aaron's going to have to leave us soon, and we'll swap in Mark Kidger, who's going to be joining us in the second half of today's program in a moment. But Aaron, obviously, for you, there just hasn't been enough corroboration of this story for you to believe it, that it does have an astronomical kind of explanation. You think in the end it was just invoked by whoever wrote the story down as a kind of sign in the heavens of that kind. So for you, you kind of gave up the quest in the end of looking for scientific explanations for the star.
Ultimately, yes, though, quite honestly, the more literary explanations are in some ways just as interesting to me. I would be fascinated by pretty much any explanation, so long as the evidence points that way. But again, I've tried carefully parsing out the meaning of the texts, the commentaries on this sort of material, and the scholarship for the last nearly 2,000 years, and coming to the conclusions I do. And also then, of course, the historical question, because even if we accept a natural explanation can't fit the star, if one believes in miracles, then this doesn't really cause a problem. And then, of course, the question is, just as Colin is saying, well, how do we choose how reliable he is? How well does he fit the larger historical context? It's true that, of course, he depicts Herod as a not too nice guy. That's very true. On the other hand, though, there are things that Matthew seems to be suggesting that we know aren't true or should have been leaving a much bigger historical record. First thing is the Magi themselves. Who are they supposed to be? Well, Magi from the East, as he mentioned, are part of the Zoroastrian priesthood, which is a completely different religion, begging the question, why are Zoroastrians worried or caring about a Jewish Messiah? I mean, how often are Christians worried about bodhisattvas in Buddhism? It seems very odd that all of a sudden this group of priests, high priests in another religion, in another region, make a long trek to see someone who is just allegedly the Messiah in a much smaller religion. Next thing, though, of course, is really the question of astrology. The idea that the Magi are supposed to be astrologers, that seems to be in the Gospel's background. But in fact, what we know about the Magi, they weren't actually astrologers at this time. This was believed by the Greeks because they thought Zoroaster, the founder of Zoroastrianism, created astrology. But this was just Greek speculation on his name, quite literally.
I'm going to have to hurry you just because we're running out of time in this section, Aaron. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. You feel like there are elements of Matthew's story that don't add up in that way.
Yes, and just very quickly, the biggest thing is the Magi are part of the Persian government. Them coming into a Roman territory, declaring someone else king, would not have only have perturbed the local court of Herod, it would have perturbed the court of Caesar Augustus. This should have caused a diplomatic showdown, if not a war. This should have been on pretty much every newspaper, quote unquote, of antiquity, and yet it left no record at all.
Okay.
That, I think, is devastating on top of the fact we have no reason to believe Matthew had a reliable source to this. Eyewitness testimony, by the time Matthew wrote, everyone who was involved would have been dead. Well, what he tells us is fantastical, and it conflicts with other pieces of history. So I would have to say, very, very probably, this is not what happened.
Okay. Well, thank you for bringing your perspective to the program today, Aaron. Really appreciate you being involved in this section of the show. We're going to be joined, as I say, by Mark Kidger, and perhaps we'll pursue his view on the Magi and hear Colin's response again to that as we continue in today's program. This is Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. And if you want to find out more about my guests, do go to the website, premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable, the show where Christians and non-Christians talk, dialogue, and discuss. And we'll be back in a short moment's time with part two.
Premier Christianity for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories.
Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
Have you heard the one about the three comedians who walked into a church? In our New Year edition, meet Milton Jones, Sally Phillips and Paul Carenza as they have a conversation on putting together their faith with careers in TV and radio comedy. Plus, we talk to the Reverend Richard Coles, former 80s pop star, now one of the UK's most famous vicars. Sam Hales attends a New Age fair and tells you what happened. All that plus much more.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of Unbelievable. Again, apologies for my voice, which has been a little bit croaky over the last week or two. But we're enjoying a discussion on was there a Star of Bethlehem? And if there was, what might have caused it? This is a Christmas Eve edition of Unbelievable. We're following the Star of Bethlehem, or at least following the evidence for and against it today. We've had already joining us Aaron Adair, an atheist, talking about his view that it was just really a theological invention, that there's really no good evidence from the science that there would have been such an event in the skies. Colin Nicol is on the line, author of The Great Christ Comet, Revealing the True Star of Bethlehem. He was engaging with Aaron's view there and is going to come back on that in a minute's time. And joining us also in the studio now is Mark Kidger, who is from the European Space Agency. You're still working with the European
Space Agency? Yes, I am.
It's great to have you back on the show, Mark. Though this is the first time we've met in person.
Yes, we've talked a number of times, but this is the first time I've actually been here.
Well, which is lovely.
And it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, you're very kind. No, it's great to have you in studio. I want to come back and talk to you about your theories that you've looked at over many years now, actually, for the Star of Bethlehem, and the fact that you're doing a fresh version of your book next year with some of the updated sort of stuff that you've been looking into around the Star of Bethlehem.
Yes, that's right. I've gone back right to square one, and I'm looking at all the evidence anew.
Okay.
And I'm having a few surprises, things that people have just assumed for years were true. I'm finding maybe they're not as true as we thought.
Okay. So we'll come back to that. The Star of Bethlehem, an astronomer's view, was what your book was originally called, of course, and we'll hear what some of the stuff you've been digging up. Now, but just coming back to what Aaron was saying in that last section, Colin, I think you wanted to come back on some of the issues he had with the Magi in particular. That was his big historical issue, and I'll be interested to hear what Mark has to say on this as well. But he just felt that visitors of that kind in that culture would have left a more lasting impression than just showing up in Matthew's gospel. We would have heard about it in other ways as well. What's some of your takeaways on what Aaron was saying there?
Well, I think, first of all, with regard to origin, I think Aaron, to be honest, has misunderstood origin. Origin has an interpretive approach which is very distinctive. It sees a literal meaning and an allegorical meaning. The various statements which Aaron is taking to suggest that Origen had a miraculous view are based upon Origen's allegorical take on the text. On a literal level, it seems plain that Origen had a straightforward view that it was a comet, or a type of comet. In fact, I can quote, he said, "It should be reckoned with the celestial bodies which occur from time to time, known as hairy stars, beams, beards, wine jars, or any other such name by which the Greeks like to describe their various forms." And then he goes on to say, we'll establish our argument in this way. Those are all different types and categories of comet as the ancients thought of them. So I think that's one response I'd have. As for Ignatius, I do think that when one takes account of the fact that it is hymnic material, the description of the star is quite striking and is very much compatible with something. It says it's very bright. It says it caused astonishment. So it's worthy evidence to be taken on board. As for the whole thing about this causing, if this was true, it would have caused a major diplomatic showdown. I think, quite honestly, that's an exaggeration of the political and diplomatic significance of what actually happened. The Magi, when they come to Jerusalem, don't go straight to Herod. They're not ushered straight into his court. They speak just to the people of Jerusalem. This seems initially to be, yes, a surprising somewhat astonishing event, but not a big diplomatic event. And I certainly don't think that Josephus would have had to mention something like this. I mean, if you look at the Josephus account, he's particularly concerned with Herod's final year, his years, his paranoia, his attempt to establish his dynasty. But this is not something that you would expect, in my opinion, to be in Josephus. So then we'll probably talk a little bit with Mark about the Magi, but I myself am not persuaded that they are Zoroastrians, and I'm not persuaded that, of the whole idea that they're kind of Persian officials. So that undermines that
okay.
point, really.
Well, we will come to your theory as well. I'm sure Mark will want to engage with that, but we're kind of starting, as you join us now, Mark, with the Magi themselves and who they were. Now, as I say, you first wrote your book, The Star of Bethlehem, An Astronomer's View, I think in about 99, 2000. So, you know, 16 years has passed since then. What were your views on the Magi then? And what kind of has developed in the interim as you've looked into it?
Right. Okay. Well, when I started, I think a lot of people 20, 30 years ago thought about Babylon as the origin of the Magi. Although there's absolutely no evidence for that whatsoever. There is nothing. Zilch. And then I started looking at some of the evidence that maybe the Magi came from Persia. Now, interesting, talk about Josephus. We know that there was a delegation of Magi that visited Rome. 66 AD, King Tiridates of Armenia visited Rome with a delegation of Magi. There, it is very well described in history.
Mm-hmm.
That was a diplomatic incident. He was coming to pay homage to Emperor Nero, and he brought an army of several thousand with him. And they went through the countries on their route from Armenia like locusts, because they expected the countries they were passing through to feed and house them. That certainly various Roman historians picked up that story.
Mm.
Now, the Magi of Matthew looks to be a much smaller level incident. It's something that it was a smaller group. But when you look into early Christian representations of the Nativity, now you read often they're in Persian garb. I can't find a single early representation of the Magi that does not show them in Persian garb.
Right.
They're in Rome in the catacombs, they're in Bethlehem in the Church of the Nativity, they're in Ravenna in the famous church there. Mm. All over, the earlier representations of the Magi are exclusively as in Persian garb. You have two apocryphal Bibles, the Armenian Book of the Infancy, the Arab Gospel of the Nativity, I seem to remember. They also mention the Magi. They talk about them in great detail as Persians.
So for you, it feels like what evidence we do have points towards
everything
Persia.
That we know points to Persia. We know the Persians would have been very interested. They had contact with Rome. They had contact. They had similar beliefs. They believed in the Messiah. There were good reasons for thinking they would be interested in the birth of a Messiah. So, no, it's not proof, but everything pushes in the same direction for me.
Now, could they still be Zoroastrian from Persia, or is that sort of...
They could be perfectly... The Magi were a sect of priests. They were associated with Zoroastrianism, and they were a priestly caste. They were scholars. So, yes, it's... But not necessarily Zoroastrians, although that would have given them a very good reason to be interested in the Magi. They believed in the virgin birth. They had their own story of the Messiah. Beliefs that are so familiar.
Right. I mean, do you concur more or less, or any differing views on this, Colin, yourself?
Well, a little bit, to be honest. While I must say it's a privilege to talk with you, Mark, and I did really enjoy your book. On this particular topic, I might be a little bit closer to where you were before. It seems to me, you know, magos in Greek can be used in one of two senses, either in a strict kind of Persian sense of a Persian priest, or in a looser sense of astrologers, astronomers, often with an association with Babylon. So there's quite a big question then. Then you get the Septuagint of Daniel, which seems to associate them with the Chaldeans. The fact that these particular people have obviously records of when the star first appeared, that suggests, you know, that they're probably professional astronomers. It would be unlikely if anyone else would have taken note of that kind of moment. That Babylon was an astronomical center, that it's east of Jerusalem, of course, so is Persia. But remember, Babylon is actually part of Parthia, so there is a kind of general Parthian category under which they're operating. Certainly it was strong in the early church. Origen, Jerome, Augustine thought it was Babylon. And I would say probably the majority of New Testament scholars, or at least half, would believe that it was Babylon. And there is the issue of Tertullian and the early Christians being embarrassed by the association with astrology from the story of the Magi. So for those various reasons, I would be more inclined to see them as astronomers and astrologers rather than priests in that sense.
It's a very interesting question. And of course, everything comes back to this one word in Matthew, which is the word magos. And the underlying difficulty. So when everybody prepares a new version of the Bible, they say proudly they've gone back to the original Greek version of the Gospel. Which is the original Greek version of the Gospel? It's a codex which is in the Vatican that was compiled about the year 1500. So 1,500 years after the events, based on fragmentary documents that were written previously. We've got fragments of the Gospel of Matthew from about the 3rd century AD, so 300 years after the events, but it's only a tiny fragment. There are actually discrepancies between some of the very oldest versions and the official codex in the Vatican, and we're all hanging on one word, which may be mistranslated, it may have been passed down incorrectly by history. This is one of the big problems that we've got, and it's why there are so many reasonable interpretations of the events.
Of the events. Do you want to come back, Colin, before we start talking about the star itself?
Well, I mean, speaking of textual criticism, I think in general, the text of the New Testament is pretty widely accepted. Yes, there are some issues, a number of issues you can see in any textual commentary of the New Testament. But, you know, the text is reasonably settled, and the discrepancies that there are really, for the most part, are well easily understood. And it's a science in and of itself trying to work out how these mistakes and changes came about. There isn't really a controversy as such about the word magos, I don't think. But, you know, I think I would just want to maybe say to Mark maybe that the New Testament text would be a little bit more regarded as more stable than maybe what Mark is suggesting.
Well, regardless of the questions about whether, you know, how we interpret magos and was that original word that Matthew would have used, the thing that people are most interested in is the star itself, and that has been the subject of many theories. Now, we heard at the beginning of this program, you were describing, Colin, that you weren't convinced by the theory of a conjunction of planets such as Jupiter and Venus and so on, that have been, you know, doing the rounds and have been popular for, well, a century or two or more in terms of explanations for this. Colin, perhaps you'd first of all explain why you eventually settled on the view that it is a comet specifically that is being described, and why you think that is the best explanation for the data we have.
Well, there are a number of reasons why I think a comet is most likely. The fact that the star appears suddenly and remains visible for over a year. I say that because Herod bases the maximum age of the infant slaughtered upon when the star first appeared. That suggests those two, the fact that it appears suddenly and remains for a year, suggests it's either a great comet or a supernova. The fact, I think, that the Magi say that this star has done something at its rising, and if we accept that that is a particular important occasion in an astronomical entity's career, what the scholars call a hiacal rising, then that is a moment that is really very visually unimpressive in the case of most bodies, and very predictable as far as the ancients were concerned at that time. So the fact that the Magi seem to be surprised by this and also are impressed by this, really it seems to me a comet is uniquely able to impress and surprise at its heliacal rising, because it's coming closest to the sun at that point and therefore is degassing in a kind of hyperactive way. So it seems to me that's more fitting, that language of rising is suggestive of a comet. Of course, it seems to me that there's the issue of the movement of the star as it goes from the eastern morning sky to the southern, what I would say the most naturally, the southern evening sky, because it appears as a Magi going down southward toward Bethlehem. And that seems to me to suggest a movement. It seems to be a solar system object if we assume that the journey time was a realistic, regardless of whether it's, you know, Persia or Babylon, you're not talking any more than a couple of months. So that would seem to me to suggest a solar system object, in particular a comet. The standing over that the star does is also reconcilable or most easily explained with reference to a comet, as we've all seen images, or many of us seen images of comets standing over the horizon with their tail streaming upward. And Josephus talks about a comet that stood over Jerusalem in the run-up to the destruction of Jerusalem. And then I would also just, I mean, there's other things we can point to, and I mentioned in my book, but Numbers 24:17, Balaam's oracle about the scepter and the star that rises, the Jews in the Babylonian Talmud actually call comets scepter stars, and many translators and scholars have perceived that the Hebrew word scepter there should be actually translated comet. You'll see that in the Revised English Bible, for example. So all of these things suggest that we're dealing with a comet here, in my opinion.
Okay, thank you, because you've boiled down essentially the whole of your book into a four-minute explanation there. Appreciate that. Mark, before you come to kind of discussing the comet theory, can you give us what you think the best explanation, if there is a physical explanation for it, would be in your view?
Okay, well, you can look at what the Chinese saw. The Chinese were fantastic observers of the sky. They catalogued absolutely everything: meteor showers, aurorae, eclipses, comets, novae, supernovae, absolutely everything. And you can go through the catalogue of Chinese observations, which is very complete, it's very well translated. Contemporary as well, we're not talking about something that was written centuries later. It was what they saw when they saw it. And the thing around the time of the Nativity that they really saw that looks most interesting and most in line with what Colin's talking about is a star that they saw in March of 5 BC that lasted for about 70 days. And that, more than a comet, appears to have been a nova. And we can actually pin down its position in the sky. It was in the Milky Way, it was in the south of the constellation of Aquila.
Now just explain what a nova is for those who don't know.
Okay, so a nova is a new star, Stellum Novum from Latin. So actually it's a very, very old star. It's a pair of stars. One of the two stars has already died. It's run out of fuel, collapsed. and it is cannibalizing its companion star. So material from its companion is falling down on the nova and building up on the surface of the small star, getting hotter and hotter and more and more bothered. And then suddenly there is a tremendous nuclear explosion.
Right.
And the small star has a huge outburst of brilliance.
Okay.
So these stars appear very, very suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
Much more suddenly in most cases than a comet. It's literally a matter of you're looking at the sky one moment and a couple of hours later there's a star there that wasn't there before.
Right.
Which would be very impressive.
And so the Chinese astronomers noticed this nova.
Which would have been in the dawn sky.
Yeah.
Persia, seen from Jerusalem.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been heliacal rising. Heliacal rising means that you're the first sighting of a star in dawn. So that was used a lot to predict floods of the Nile, for example. The Egyptians used the first sighting of Sirius to predict when the Nile was going to flood,
right,
which was very important to them because it was their water supply, the water for their crops. But this star, we know it appeared in the dawn sky. We know it would have appeared very suddenly. It would have been quite bright if it was, the Chinese say 2 months, 70 days, 70 plus days. But then we run into monsoon season in China. They'd have had cloudy skies for months.
Okay.
So they would have lost sight of it. There are records of this star from Korea as well that are in some agreement. We can pin down fairly well in the sky.
Assuming
where it
that was. There was one then. I mean, how do you work it with the datings? Because 5 BC, I guess some people are going to say that's not terrible. You know, that's 5 years out from when we traditionally put the birth of Christ and so on. Or how does it work with Herod and all those kinds of other aspects that people often point to?
Let me ask you a question, Justin. When do we put the birth of Christ?
You're probably asking the wrong person for that one.
No, you're a Christian, aren't you?
Well, obviously people think of it as 0 AD, though in fact, I guess that's not the case because it's actually believed to be off, isn't it?
Exactly. There's the problem. So, zero didn't exist.
Mm.
The Romans didn't have a number zero. They didn't have a concept of zero, which is surprising. And our Western calendar, we tend to blame a Scythian monk called Dionysius Exiguus, who was writing in 525 AD for getting the calendar wrong. And this is another of the things that I've been discovering in my research. We've been calling him all kinds of names for about 400 years, probably without a great deal of justification, because what Dionysius did was he was charged with producing an Easter calendar, and he did. He produced a 90-year Easter calendar for the church. He did not actually really calculate the date of the Nativity, and it's one of those things that nobody actually knows. Did Dionysius set the date of the Nativity, his nominal Nativity? You can't see the gesture I'm making behind the mic, but as 25th of December 1 BC or 25th of December 1 AD.
Right.
So if it was 25th of December 1 BC, then the calendar suddenly jumps from 1 BC to 1 AD, which is one. And then there are all kinds of questions about when Herod died. Now, most experts believe that Herod died probably in 4 BC.
Mm-hmm.
There are various reasons for believing this. Now, the dating of Herod's death is usually given by two things: an eclipse of the moon that was visible from Jericho. Josephus describes this in great detail. And there are various historians who gave the year of Herod's death.
Mm.
But they did it in terms of how many years from the start of the reign of Emperor Augustus Caesar.
Okay.
Right. When did Augustus Caesar start to reign? Good question. He was imbued with the title of emperor in the year 27 BC. However, he defeated Mark Antony and Cleopatra, the battle of famous Battle of Actium, the naval battle, in 31 BC. And that was when he was de facto leader of the Roman world. So, if you believe that people dated the start of Augustus's reign as 31 BC, when he reigned as Octavian, his given name, then we're 5 years out with the calendar.
Right. Goodness me. It's
complicated.
Yeah, it is complicated. Colin, any views from you on where we should date the nativity itself and, you know, and how the star interacts with that?
Yeah, I mean, it really comes down to Herod's death. I think the vast majority of scholars would date that to 4 BC and therefore date the birth of Jesus to 6 or 5 BC, with some extending it to 7 BC if they're convinced by the triple conjunction theory.
Yeah, exactly. You move the date of the nativity to fit the evidence.
Okay. Well, that was a helpful kind of detour down that particular avenue. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back for a final 10 or 15 minutes to get you guys to talk about your different theories as well, so that we can hear you critique the comet theory, Mark, and equally, Mark, you can critique the nova theory as well. So keep listening. Unbelievable today, looking at the Star of Bethlehem on this Christmas Eve edition of the show. Hope you can stick with us right through till 4 o'clock this afternoon.
In July 2016, Unbelievable, the conference took place in London, a day for any Christian who struggles to share their faith with others.
I'm Justin Brierley, and I hosted a fantastic day of inspirational sessions with J. John, Gary Habermas, Beth Grove, and many others.
Now you've got the chance to watch and listen to over 12 hours of this empowering conference,
featuring evangelism, apologetics, and the resurrection.
Get your DVD at premier.org.uk/shop and become a confident evangelist today.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Christmas special of Unbelievable. We're talking about the Star of Bethlehem, fact or fiction, and I'll be concluding this discussion between my guests Colin Nicol and Mark Kidger in a moment's time. Don't forget, you can find Unbelievable online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Next week, we've the New Year's Eve edition of the programme, doing things a bit differently. I've got a number of interviews with several different women that I think you should hear. And so you'll be hearing those. One of them is Jessica Kelly. She's written a book called Lord Willing? And it's all about the death of her four-year-old son due to brain cancer and how she dealt with that theologically. She came to adopt a view known often as the warfare view, and we'll be hearing her story and what she has to say about how she came to terms with why God would allow that kind of suffering in her life. That's just one part of what you'll be hearing on next week's programme. Hope you can come back for that. We'll be having some of your feedback towards the end of today's programme. Look forward to hearing what you had to say about recent editions of the programme. And don't forget that later on today, you can hear loads more Christmas-themed programming here on Premier Christian Radio at 4 o'clock in place of The Profile. We have a special programme, Christmas in Swaldale. The Reverend Caroline Hewitt in her 4x4 heads around the Yorkshire Dale, tending to her flock in the run-up to Christmas. That should be a lot of fun. At 5 o'clock, it's Christmas carols from St Andrew's Cathedral in Glasgow. And at 6 o'clock, tinsel and tea towels. Lisa Mannering explores the fun, hilarity, harmony and magic of the humble school nativity play, and asks whether we're losing some of that as well in our culture today. So do stick around for Premier's Christmas programming. We really do put Christ back at the start of Christmas every year here on the radio station. Let's get back into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, we're concluding our discussion today on was there a Star of Bethlehem? And if there was, when did it happen? How did it happen? We've had various different points of view represented across the show today. Aaron Adair started us off. He's an atheist, and he explained why he doesn't believe there was a star. It was made up. But Colin Nicol, our Christian guest on the show, joining us via Skype today, an author of The Great Christ Comet, has been explaining why he does think we can trust the biblical records and why a comet makes best sense of the event in the skies that Matthew records. On the other hand, we've got also joining me in studio now Mark Kidger, who's an astronomer with the European Space Agency. He's done a lot of research over the years on this, and his views have changed in certain respects, but he still, I think, goes with the NOVA view as probably the best explanation, something the Chinese saw around that time, 5 BC, and then we've had that interesting conversation on when we do in fact date the Nativity, depending on when people believe Herod was alive and that kind of thing. Colin, moving us beyond those interesting questions, just for you, why did you not kind of adopt the NOVA view that Mark has put forward here, that this was something that happened, it was, you know, a special event because for the first time a star came into view, and Mark thinks he can line that up with the, you know, with a chronology of when these events happened. What, why for you didn't that work in your research in this area?
It's an interesting issue. Colin Humphreys has taken a similar view with the same object but identified it as a comet. So there's a lot of there's disagreement about it. The Chinese term, I think, usually refers to a tailed comet, a broom star comet, as they referred to it. The question really is there's no mention of motion with regard to that entity, and that could favor NOVA. On the other hand, in the Chinese records at that time or around those centuries, it's occasionally apparently true that they did not always mention subsequent movement of a comet, so it doesn't necessarily rule out a comet. I would say there are a number of things which lead me to be skeptical of that view. The first is that we wouldn't really expect, as Mark says, a nova in Capricornus. So Mark postulates that the location it has to be slightly revised, and Mark wants to bring in a 4 BC.
It was probably Southern Aquila. It's in the Milky Way.
So just say that again, Mark.
Southern Aquila. It's in the Milky Way. It's an area not very populated with stars. So the Chinese position is really quite... The Koreans actually give the position relative to the star Altair, which is one of the very brightest stars of the sky, right in the middle of the Milky Way. So it's not actually an unexpected position for a nova.
Yeah, well, that's assuming that the location in the 5 BC report is wrong and that the Korean 4 BC report is mistaken in its date. But I think the main issues really are that, as Mark acknowledges, there is no reference to a rising... it could not have risen at least... it would have been over a month prior to that being spotted by the Chinese. And Mark suggests that maybe it's bad weather, monsoon season, and that kind of thing can happen. But then you would have expected the onlookers to look the next day and say, well, then it definitely couldn't have been Haleakala rising because of its position in the sky, which, of course, is fixed. So I'm a wee bit skeptical on those grounds. The fact that it's only visible for 70 or so days is a little difficult to reconcile with Matthew. Basically, one has to say then that what Herod is basing the date of the slaughter of the infants on is not the date of the actual stars first appearing, but of some other astronomical phenomenon. The problem is that the text of Matthew, strictly speaking, does say when the star first appeared. Not differentiating it from the star that they saw rise. So I think, for those reasons, I'm reluctant to go in that direction.
Okay. I mean, you might want to respond to that,
Mark. I disagree with virtually every statement that he's made. So, for example, I work a lot with comets. Mm. I study comets a lot. A comet that's visible for 70 days to the naked eye, we don't believe that the Magi had telescopes. I think it was a few thousand years too early for that. They're very rare. The Chinese records around that time, we've got the record of Halley's Comet in 12 BC. they described its shape, the size of the tail, the colour, the movement, when it was first seen, where it was last seen. The Chinese records in general are very, very good, very precise. If they don't say that it moved, it's difficult to believe that it moved. And we can go back to the Chinese records and we can find Halley's Comet in 164 BC. We can find it in 240 BC in the records. Earlier records are not very good, but this time they're really getting pretty good at recording their observations.
Colin has criticized the NOVA view. You're here just criticizing the comet view. You don't think it corresponds, that it could have had the is Colin's view that it was Halley's Comet that was what was being seen, or am I?
Twelve BC Halley's Comet, far too early to be.
Right.
There was a comet seen in 10 BC, and that's what we call a ghost event. That was a mistake in the transcription. There was no other obvious, clear comet visible for a period around 20 years around that time.
So you don't think there is a comet in that time that would have been visible?
There is nothing that is undisputably a comet. Now, also another thing. Yes, the Chinese called it a Huixing, a hairy star. The Chinese were in the habit of using Huixing to describe any very bright star. So we know the supernova that appeared in 1572, we call Tycho supernova, appeared in Cassiopeia. They called that a Huixing, a hairy comet. Tycho called it a comet. Tycho wrote, "I am sure that comet was not in the sky last night."
Right. So they sometimes attributed the word comet
regularly attributed it.
Okay, and any responses to this, Colin? Because obviously, Mark just doesn't think that there was a comet sighted within the region we're talking about.
Yeah, it comes down, and ultimately this whole discussion of the Star of Bethlehem comes down to whether the state of the records is complete. Mark suggested earlier that they were. I don't think that's accurate by any means. When you get the studies by David Hughes on this topic suggest that on average you would expect 81 to 99 comets per century. Another scholar, Licht, estimates that there should be about 87 per century. From 50 BC to 50 AD, the Chinese records only have one-sixth of Licht's estimate. There is no Chinese record for 164 BC, and it's debatable whether there's one for 87 BC. And on that basis, F. Richard Stevenson said clearly that much data must be missing by the time Han Xu, the history of the former Han dynasty, was written. So it seems to me what we need to do is say, if there's so few remaining records of the Chinese, how we can testify that that's correct is that the Greco-Roman references to comets, there are, as Anthony Barrett has pointed out in an article, there are maybe 13 or something comets mentioned in the Chinese and the Greco-Roman literature, scattered references to comets, which are not most of which are not documented in the Chinese records. So even if you combine the two of them, there's still only a third of the expected number of comets for that period. Also look at Josephus, as he mentions a year-long comet in the run-up to the destruction of Jerusalem, which there's no Chinese record of. So it seems
you shouldn't put too much store in the Chinese records, is what you're saying. That there are other sources that you could go to, and by no means have they all been catalogued necessarily.
Yeah, and with Halley's comet, we're very fortunate because we had Chinese records covering for us. With the Babylonian records up to 87. We don't have a record of a comet after 87 from Babylon, so we're then dependent on other sources.
Okay.
So anyway, I think the Halley's Comet, the 12 BC, is not a typical representation of a Chinese record. That's exceptional, partly because it was perceived to have such astrological significance.
Okay.
And that really is what determined whether the Chinese historian kept a record of comets. and other entities because he perceived it to have an ideological significance for the writing of his history.
I see.
So I think those are various issues that are going into
which we'll have to start to draw it to a close, gentlemen. But I know I'm not going to persuade either of you to budge from your particular preferred view of the star. I mean, in the end, Mark, it's a fascinating thing, with something that marries astronomy with a great story, with history, with, you know, a cultural, something that's obviously so well loved and you know, appreciated in our culture. Do you feel like you've kind of got to the bottom of the star, or do you think there could be further interpretations, further evidence that comes to light?
Ask me again in a year. I'm still working on it. Okay. I'm becoming gradually more convinced by the evidence. There are other things we haven't discussed there. The actual date of the nativity, we've discussed the year. We haven't discussed the time of year.
Yeah.
I came up with a discovery in my research that really contradicted a lot of what people have written about this for decades, particularly people like Colin Humphreys. They seem to have made a serious mistake in the past.
And you think it may, in fact, be closer to the date we've traditionally ascribed to Christmas.
I think it may actually be Christmas.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, there's a good reason for it, that Colin Humphreys argues very convincingly, shepherds in the field watching their flocks, and I've spoken to shepherds who tend flocks in the Spanish plains, very similar conditions to Bethlehem, and they say, yes, we keep the animals under shelter during the winter, we would only be out all night during lambing season. Fine. That assumes that the lambing season in Bethlehem was the same as the lambing season as it is in the United Kingdom, for example. It isn't. So I went back to some United Nations Food Agency reports, found information on the type of sheep that are kept in Palestine, Israel, Syria, and it's a special breed of sheep that's been used for something like 5,000 years.
Wow.
Their lambing time is November, December. Why? Because that's the rainy season. Any lamb that was born in March or April would die of starvation because there would be no fodder.
How interesting. I wish we had more time to go into some of these interesting things.
This was the sort of thing that I've been discovering in my research.
We look forward to it. Obviously, you're on a really interesting journey to discover some of these things. Colin, your book, of course, is available if people want to read your own view on this. Again, The Great Christ Comet, Revealing the True Star of Bethlehem. Available from all good Christian bookshops and online outlets and so on. Thanks for the interesting discussion. It's been an interesting hour talking through these issues. Appreciate you being on the line with us, Colin.
Thank you so much, Justin. It was a privilege to talk to you, Mark, and you, Justin.
Thanks very much to you as well, Colin. It's a pleasure to speak to you, although I think we disagree on one or two points.
We'll do it again in a year or two. But Mark, it's been fun as well having you in the studio.
And it's always fun.
I really hope that you know your revised version of the book does. I'm sure will hopefully answer a few mysteries and maybe I'll put a few questions out there as well.
Yep, yeah, I'm just trying to go back skeptically to the very first part, all the things that people think they know about the Star of Bethlehem, and just look at them again properly.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being with me on the programme today.
And thanks to you.
Thank you for listening as well. We're going to hear some of your feedback in a short moment's time. And if you want to get in touch with today's programme, I'll be giving you the ways to do that as well.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
As ever, if you want to get in touch about today's show, do encourage you to email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And do tell me what you'd like to feature on Unbelievable in 2017 as well. I often put out a call for people, both via the Facebook and Twitter account at about the start of the new year, to ask what you'd like to see me feature on the programme. Guests, topics, that kind of thing. So if you've got an idea, do feel free to email it in. I do try to take on board as many suggestions as possible from show listeners all around the world. You can also find us, of course, online and engage with the show that way as well at the Facebook and Twitter accounts, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, @unbelievablejb to follow me on Twitter. All the links, more, today's programme, today's guests available from the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Big fan of Unbelievable, says Theo Mead. I'd love for you to have John Mark Miraval on your programme. In my opinion, he gives one of the best defences of traditional marriage. Here's a link to one of his debates on same-sex marriage. Thank you very much, Theo. As I say, suggestions always welcome. I can't, of course, make all of them happen, but the ones that really seem to, you know, fit well with the show and seem worth doing, I'll always try and make happen if I can. This from JD wants to go back to that podcast only edition of the programme in which I aired that debate between David Wood and Michael Shermer, simply titled Does God Exist? JD says, I listened to the debate between Wood and Shermer. In his opening statement, Shermer brings up the old thousands of gods argument. Since humans have come up with thousands of God concepts in the course of their history, of which the Christian God is only one, how likely is it that the Christian one out of all those thousands is true? And I'm currently pursuing a statistics degree. The fallacy in this argument became clear for the first time. It's the assumption that all those thousands of God concepts are equally likely. This assumption works in the case of, for instance, rolling a fair dice or drawing a particular card, like the Queen of Hearts, from a card deck. In these cases, the probability of each of the possible outcomes can be found simply by taking one divided by the total number of possible outcomes. Now, if you assume that all God concepts humans have come up with are equally likely with regard to explanatory power, etc., then Shermer's point stands. But if we're really careful and notice that we're considering candidates, not just for any God whatsoever, but for the ultimate, unconditioned, transcendent creator and sustainer of all that is, then it becomes clear that most God concepts fail the test. Many gods are parochial, territorial gods that are just as much a part of creation as human beings, trees, etc., and so couldn't play the role of ultimate creator. In many traditions, separate gods are considered partial manifestations of the one, which alone is the ultimate reality, so those wouldn't be separate contenders either. Once you filter out all the lesser parochial gods and spirits, the number of possible candidates for ultimate principle of reality get narrowed down very considerably. The Christian God, which is also, of course, the Jewish God, competing only with the Islamic conception and possibly some varieties of Hindu impersonal ultimism, says JD. Yeah, interesting response. I hadn't seen one quite like that to that old atheist chestnut, JD, but thanks for sending that in. Here's Andrew, who says right at the top of his email, I will apologise now for the small novel I'm going to write you in this email. As what I would call myself a recovering Christian, I want to let you know that I really enjoy your programme. I came across it as I've had what I will call an identity crisis of who I am and who Jesus and God are. As an American, it's refreshing to hear a different voice talking about Christianity than the stereotypical ones here in this country. I like that you talk about subjects that I've never heard talked about a lot in the church growing up. I realise you probably get bombarded with topic suggestions, but I feel that these issues have been on my heart and would love to hear these someday. That of legalism in the church, materialism, and the buying of possessions, and what's actually considered sin. With that final topic, I feel, with my limited knowledge of theology in the Bible, but knowing my heart, that sin feels like a blanket term. As everyone is different, can something be sinful if it's not what trips up someone? For example, with lust and pornography, while I know it can be harmful to some, I can watch it and walk away and remain in control with respect to women and sex, knowing that it's fake. It hasn't caused me to stalk someone or covet with intent to take away someone's wife, such as King David did with Bathsheba, whereas my struggle is gossip and judgment of people and friends behind their backs instead of having direct conversations, which has caused me to lose those friendships. I bring this up because I wonder if it's blown out of proportion. Every internet search on Christians and pornography is always labelled as an addiction or an epidemic. Is it really that? Or do we just not want to admit that as Christians we're as flawed and have vices and we have to put up this veil of Christian purity? I've recently started going to a church church, and the people who greeted me within a very short time had told me so many deep, dark and personal stories about them. I knew more about them in 5 minutes than people I'd gone to church with 10 years with. We call it disarming a threat, in which we don't put on a mask or an act. Anyway, I'll force myself to stop there, since I have far more I could bring up. Keep up the good work and conversation. Thank you, Andrew. Well, the subject of pornography is certainly one we could tackle again. Haven't done it in quite a while. Though, funnily enough, in the December edition of Premier Christianity magazine, we did an article on that subject, looking at the way that, in many ways, mainstream culture is somewhat turning against pornography. And while you may say you think you can, you know, keep a lid on it and it doesn't affect you badly and so on, the fact is that research does seem to be suggesting that as more and more people, especially young people, are regularly accessing pornography on the internet, it's changing the way they view sexuality, sexual relationships in a quite unhealthy way. You know, you might want to avail yourself of some of those kinds of statistics and research, Andrew, because from my personal perspective, I've always felt, from a Christian spiritual moral point of view, pornography is bad. I think also, though, you can empirically see that it's bad for society as well. Whether or not we feel, you know, it doesn't really affect me, of course, that doesn't necessarily take into the account of the people who are on the other side of the camera and so on as well, of course. But anyway, appreciate you getting in touch, Andrew, and all the very best with your recovering Christian journey. Ken Miles, finally, this takes us right back to August, September, when I aired those two shows where I spoke to famed UK illusionist and mentalist Darren Brown about his atheism and former Christian faith. Thank you for your excellent podcast, says Ken. I often listen to them when driving. I was particularly interested by your recent interviews with Darren Brown. I'm an Anglican, and as a medical doctor specialising in the radiology of cancer, and so the issues around healing are of particular relevance to me. As an aside, Darren's confidence that x-rays can consistently provide evidence of healing is a little misplaced. There are anti-cancer drugs that prolong the lives of patients without producing any change in size of the tumour on x-rays. If drugs can do this, I'm sure God can do the same. However, it's in the in-studio conversations after the interview that moved me to write. The participants, including yourself, were clearly very unsettled by Darren Brown's miracle show, which I haven't had the opportunity to see for myself, even to the point of wondering whether the inclusion of music within a church service might merely be a psychological trick. A more nuanced understanding of divine action, coupled with a renewed awareness of long-standing ideas about the validation of religious experience and how these relate to the practice of religious worship, might have reduced the degree of discomfort. Firstly, divine action. The discussion group stated that God has the power to do anything, which is no doubt true, but with one important proviso, that it is an act of unselfish love. If God did anything else, he would cease by definition to be God. God's love can therefore be considered such that he couldn't undertake any action that failed to respect the inherent character of the things he's created, as reflected by Jesus's refusal to turn stones into bread. Similarly, the human body is a physical object in creation, and so divine action on humans will also respect the natural processes within the human body. In view of the complexity of human biology, it's conceivable that natural processes in the human can be in a range of states that are more or less open to divine action. The components of religious worship, including music, can be seen as ways of modifying bodily states so as to increase the openness of human beings to divine action. Hence, someone with an injured eye at a church service could feasibly be more open to divine action than a baby with AIDS. However, these body states will not be unique to religious worship, and comparable states could be generated by other situations, including Darren Brown's show, but in a context that may not necessarily be associated with divine action. So the problem becomes one of discerning when a particular experience is a true experience of God. This issue was considered in depth by the 14th century Saint Catherine of Siena, who helpfully concluded that a true experience of God would be associated with an increase in the expression of unselfish love by the recipient of the experience. Hearing the accounts of people leaving Darren Brown's miracles, it seems unlikely that many people experiencing his show would subsequently exhibit such an increase in unselfish love. Thank you very much. You've tried to keep this email brief, but if more explanation about divine action is required, you also attached an article you wrote recently. Ken, very interesting. Thank you for that perspective. Always enjoy hearing people's views on these issues. And we've reached the end of today's show. So I'll bid you a happy Christmas wherever you are, however you're celebrating it. And I hope you can come back for Unbelievable. Same time next week, it'll be New Year's Eve. And I've got a special programme for you then. You're unbelievable. I'll be airing interviews with a couple of different women whose stories I'd like you to hear, including the story of Jessica Kelly, who lost her four-year-old son to brain cancer. We all hear how she dealt with that and the theology, really, that she used to deal with it as well. Fascinating story and a very brave woman. Join me for that same time, same place next week. Until then, happy Christmas.